Welcome to the Danielle Strickland Podcast. We're glad you're here. We hope this episode challenges and inspires you, disrupts and invites you to go deeper and further with Jesus. For more resources, go to daniellestrickland.com.
Welcome to the Danielle Strickland Podcast. My co-host, James. James, please meet Kyle. We have Kyle Howard on, which we're super thrilled and humbled and excited that you came, Kyle, to be with us on this podcast. The season's called Mind Blown. And we're just going through truth that is blowing our mind and changing the way that we're living. And we're excited to be doing it with you. So Christian theologian, preacher, trauma-informed, soul care provider. I found you on Twitter. I'm so grateful for the way that you've ministered to me through your Twitter posts. So thank you for that. Do you want to give any more introduction to folks so they know a little bit about your background?
Yeah. First off, thank you so much for having me. It's my privilege and I'm excited to talk with you all today. And so as you mentioned, I am a trauma-informed soul care provider and I guess a public theologian, I guess would be another title. I don't know how I feel about that title, but
there's a lot of public theologians right now. You might not want to be associated with like all of them.
When I say that, I kind of feel like I'm saying I'm a blogger. But so I did a couple degrees at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. I did an associate's in biblical theological studies. My bachelor's is in biblical counseling. And then I did an advanced MDiv in historical theology. But a few classes shy of finishing that advanced MDiv, and I decided, a couple semesters, I decided to kind of shorten it to a master's in theology, just because I kind of want to, I'm ready to kind of break out of this, fully out of this whole Southern Baptist, you know, dynamic. But my two fields are essentially soul care or Christian counseling, trauma-informed Christian counseling, and historical theology, where I've largely focused in patristic, studying the North African church fathers, and as well as the Reformation and kind of the North African church fathers' influence on the Reformation, which, yeah.
Yeah, we're going to get into it, I'd imagine, because that blew your mind or like, you know, so this idea of, okay, so the first thing you want to do, there's some things that you've written and that you share as a public theologian, which I'm helpful for and I'm fine with. I think that's awesome. I think the platforms of the Reformation that we're in are vastly shifting. So if you're, you know, I kind of liken it to John Wesley not being allowed to preach inside the church. So he just goes into the field and then God does this great work with a guy in a field. And I feel like Twitter's like a field in so many ways, right? And social media in general has become this alternative platform that I feel like God is using very powerfully to liberate and to help. And also, of course, the enemy wants as well. But I see you as a voice there of great truth and great power and great love. So I'm so thankful for you. But I would I have things that blew my mind that you've shared, which maybe we can get to in a little bit. But when we talk about having your mind blown, where it's like a real paradigm shift, a real repentance, I would say a metanoia, like a different way of seeing everything. What is it that came to your mind? Like what is that? Is there a moment or a truth or a theological concept that was like, oh yeah, I'm never going to be the same again?
Yeah. So I kind of probably came to that in kind of a different way in that. Again, I was saved, 19 years ago. And when I became a believer, I didn't grow up in the church. I didn't grow up going to VBS. I got introduced into the Christian ward as an adult. I was 18, first semester of high school. My only influence in Christianity was from my grandfather, my white grandfather, paternal grandfather, who was a white Methodist pastor in inner city DC during the civil rights era. And so he was serving within a predominantly black community. Of course, he married a black woman. But by the time I was born, or I guess you could say of age, he had largely became agnostic. Just based upon a lot of the things that he saw in life and experiences and everything else. And so growing up, the only kind of real experience I had with the church was I was basically from a secular family. My mom experienced racial trauma in the church when she many years ago, she stopped going to church. My grandfather was no longer a pastor. And so, again, my church experience was largely negative, or my understanding. But I never read the Bible. I didn't have any kind of, it was largely, again, just secular. So all that to say that when in my freshman year of college, when I got, I had kind of a radical conversion experience. And after that conversion experience, it was like an entire new world opened up to me. And my first year as a believer, because it was such a complete worldview shock, I literally dropped out of college, moved back to Atlanta, got a part-time job with just enough money to put a roof over my head and food in my belly. And I spent all of my time outside of that just reading the Bible. And so my first year as a believer, I read through the entire Bible about 6-7 times.
Wow.
And, I mean, I was just reading through. I was just reading through, trying to understand what in the world just happened. What is this thing called Christianity that I now believe in, but don't know any much about other than Jesus saves? You know, but with that, after reading through the Bible over and over again, I became, I guess, reformed in my soteriology and my understanding of salvation. What people typically call Calvinistic. I kind of became reformed, not through reading different reformed leaders, but just through reading the Bible. But naturally, and it was within a Black church that was a campus ministry. But naturally, because of, even though I was part of a Black church, I was a church that was going kind of going the way of more prosperity theology. While at the same time, I was reading the scriptures and coming to conclusions regarding Reformation theology. I started gravitating towards resources online. I guess because, you know, the whole Young Restless Reform Movement type thing. Well, I was reading all these various authors and stuff, from the Pipers to the, I don't know, even MacArthur's, to various other kinds of people. And as I gravitated more towards that ward, I ultimately found myself within the kind of Reformed Baptist, even Southern Baptist ward. Never really looking at myself as being a Southern Baptist per se, but just kind of, hey, you know, there's a lot of theological things we have in common here. Well, for years, I served in that space, ultimately was a lay leader doing crisis counseling in a church in that space. And then my family and I moved to Louisville, Kentucky, where I began going to seminary in that space. So now I'm getting theological education in that space. And then comes about 2014, 2015, when you kind of have the death of Trayvon Martin, which kind of as a side note, both my parents are attorneys. My dad is a criminal defense attorney. My mom's a civil attorney. And so when Trayvon Martin was killed, I didn't say anything on social media about that because I knew the legalities behind it. Even though it was mad suspect in regards to who was responsible, I knew that Zimmerman wasn't going to get charged just based upon what I knew about the law. And so I didn't say anything. But then when Mike Brown was killed, And then later on it was Eric Garner. Eric Garner was killed, that was the first time I spoke up. And if you remember, Eric Garner was the one who was crying out, "I can't breathe, I can't breathe," as he was choked to death by police officers. And I remember going on social media, and this is the moment. So this is to answer your question, this paradigm shift. Was I got on social media on Facebook. I posted the video of Eric Garner and I said that this is a travesty of justice. This is evil. I don't remember what I said, but it wasn't anything crazy, but it was just like acknowledging, you know, how this made me feel. And I had several seminary friends all separately private message me, and they all essentially said the same thing, which, and one of them encapsulated what one of them said that it sticks with me the most, which was, "I thought you were one of us. Why are you talking about these things?" And wow. All of them in some sense communicated that message where, hey, you're supposed to be with one of us. Why are you talking about Eric Garner? Why are you, oh, you're not getting into the whole social justice stuff, are you? And that was the moment where there was beginning to be this major paradigm shift of, wait a second, what do you mean one of you versus one of us? How is me identifying as Black and empathizing with the Black community? This is compromising the us. What's going on here? And so that was the beginning of coming to terms with the fact that all of the theology that I already believed regarding the Imago Dei, regarding the gospel, even again, because again, coming from somebody who's read through the entire Bible numerous times, and even within the Reformation tradition, it was understood that the gospel was not this hyper individualistic message, but it was about the cosmic reconciliation and reunification of all things in Christ, the entire cosmos being brought into subjection under Christ. And so that was my theology, even of the gospel, to then finding out that even some of the very people, my professors even, were holding to this hyper individualistic gospel, which was, we're saved. We don't worry about what's happening to the Black community. Don't worry about what's happening to women abuse, all these kinds of things. And so it was at that moment that I realized that I was holding to a theological worldview that never changed, was always consistent, but everyone else around me, from professors to pastors, had even though they were teaching the same things, had a completely different worldview and perspective about issues of the Imago Dei, the image of God, issues of justice, and even Christ's posture towards the marginalized and all those kinds of things. And so that was kind of the big moment where I kind of realized so it wasn't really like a thing of, when people talk about like decolonizing your theology, there wasn't really an element where I felt like I really needed to do decolonizing of my theology as much as needing to come to terms with the fact that the theology that I had embraced and been living by and actually believed to the point that I was living by it wasn't really the theology. I wasn't really in a like-minded theological community.
Does that make sense? It's like you didn't get the private memo that says we preach this, but we don't actually believe it.
Yeah. And right. So that only overflowed even more. So again, then when you had, with the Black Lives Matter movement that started happening, then when you have the rise of Trump, even when it comes to, you know, his bragging about sexual assault and all these mm-hmm. kinds of things, I'm sitting here as someone who was a lay leader and crisis counselor, literally counseling women who had been raped and sexually assaulted in the church, you know, with my wife, you know, by my side, you know, counseling these sisters, thinking that, you know, people who had oversight over me or leadership and everything, so we're all on the same page. And so when I ultimately, and I get this in the most decisive moment, was when I was essentially approached by pastors at the time, and they told me about church, and they told me that if I wanted to advance in leadership or have any kind of relationship with the pastors, that I would need to stop publicly speaking out against Trump, and I would need to stop publicly speaking out about social justice issues.
Wow.
And so to me, that was the paradigm shifter, where it was like coming to terms with the fact, and I think that, and I want to be careful how I say this, that it's, I was living in a worldview, my wife alongside with me, that was, we actually believe this. Like the things that we say about Jesus, the worldview that we've adopted and embraced through our understanding of Christian history, we actually believe this stuff. And so we were living in accordance with what we believed. And what I came to understand was, and not just this also goes with the Southern Baptist Convention and work and then everything else, was that everyone around me who has some degree of power does not actually believe in what they're saying they believe or what they're teaching. The entire platform that has been built on theological propositions is all politics and all games, and it's all about power. And so, and there's layers that I'm happy to answer questions on, but it was when I came to terms with the fact that I am an anomaly in that I actually believe what I say I believe, was a massive paradigm shifter of understanding that there are two groups of Christians. There were those many, not all, but many with power in the church who are weaponized theology and have weaponized faith in order for self-elevation and self-exaltation. And then there are those under those people with power who actually believe in Jesus and believe in the Bible and what they're teaching, and they're living accordingly. And so it was just coming to terms. And then the thing was that I was kind of more in that middle ground, as I was a lay leader. I was in positions of leadership as a young, just to be frank, as a young Black theologian with gifts. There was a lot of people who were like making appeals to me, you know, ministries wanted me to write for them or speak for them and everything else. So I was kind of in that middle ground where I saw behind the veil of it all, but I hadn't stepped over, and realizing that this is all just a bunch of misdirection. I'm trying to think of polite words to use, but this is all just a massive farce.
You don't have to be polite, does he? No, Carl doesn't have to be polite, does he? That's
no, I've actually, I found that.
Audience. Usually I ask what my audience is before I do an interview.
Yeah, no, I think most mind-blown moments don't have polite responses to them. Yeah. That's true, isn't it? Most of your ears is like, ah, I can't even quote myself in some of my mind-blown moments. But that is, I mean, Kyle, that is a fascinating. So the paradigm, like it instantly sort of this, there's this shift where you realize, oh, like I don't belong, or I don't even want to belong if this is what the invitation is to belong to. Like I, this is not what it is that I want. I don't want to be on that side, whatever that side, you didn't draw the line, they drew the line, but then you're like, I don't even want in there, whatever that is. But then I guess as with all mind blown paradigm shifting things, once you see it, you can't unsee it. And yeah. Then in my experience, and I feel like from your writing, it just became clearer and clearer and clearer, and maybe worse and worse in some ways, as you saw it.
Yeah. Fighting cynicism is hard. Let me put it this way. The line between cynicism and realism becomes so thin that it's discombobulating because you don't want to become the cynical, you know, but you want to operate in the realm of realism, and the line becomes so thin in regards to where one is versus the other, that it can kind of be like, I don't even know how to process this. Mm-hmm. And full transparency, full disclosure, and some of this I haven't even really fully worked out, but it did come to the point for me. So when I decided to leave my church, when I decided that I cannot be in a space that is seeking to muzzle me when it comes to issues that are gospel issues, mm-hmm. See, I don't consider social justice, advocating for social justice. I'm not talking about the ideology of social justice, but simply the pursuit of justice within the social realm. That I don't see that as simply a side issue or, yeah. I'm trying to think about how the way that people typically phrase it, an implication of the gospel. Mm-hmm. I consider that as part of the gospel because again, the gospel is the good news of cosmic redemption and reconciliation and unification. So the fact that the principalities and powers in the heavenly places of darkness currently war, and the gates of hell will not prevail against the church, as the church presses forward with its light, it is pressing against, you know, various systems of darkness that includes injustice.
Yeah.
So to me, that was central. And I couldn't be in a space that was telling me, we want you to be a gospel minister, but not minister the gospel comprehensively. We want you to truncate the gospel and then minister that. To me, that was unfaithfulness. And so when I left that space, and I began, you know, operating, you know, seeing what's behind that veil when it comes to various ministries that I thought were like faithful, large ministries to denominations and everything else. I concluded, and I'm not saying I've even changed my mind at this point, but I concluded ultimately that my ministry is done. You know, I got all these degrees in Bible and theology, and there's nothing that I will be able to do with it because it's all a farce. You know, wow. And so I will never forget when we left the day that we decided that we were going to leave our church, and I did feel called to pastoral ministry. I was sitting at my desk and I was just crying, and I was crying because, I mean, it hurts as much as it's worth. And so I was like, I love ministry. I love shepherding. I love caring for God's people, but I can't do that anymore because it's all fake. And I thought ministry was over. So I was just weeping over the loss of that passion. And my wife came to me and told me that, you know, I've never been more, and put her hand on my shoulder and said, I've never been more proud of you. And, but she said that with both of us basically acknowledging this is the end. This is the end, that ministry is now over, but I'm proud of the way that you went out. You went out not willing to compromise for wanting ministry, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Wow.
And so, but it was after that, that God began opening doors for me to begin building relationships with other people in ministry who were also outliers, who had also in many ways been pushed outside the camp. And I began realizing, and even when it came to my social media, all these people began following me. And I'm like, I was surprised when I reached 100 to 200 followers, like there's other people that actually, you know, agree with me about, you know, these kinds of things. And so I learned over time that there are a massive group of people that are in a similar boat, where they've come to realize that much of what they've been taught has more been about power dynamics rather than actually about, you know, a faithful expression of faith. So ministry wasn't over. It was the beginning of ministry. It just mm-hmm. looked radically different than what I was, you know, wanting to, or expecting to do. You know,
I actually think that's so beautiful, Kyle, because I feel like, you know, and this might be true, helpful to some listeners, is sometimes what we're afraid about in the mind blown space, right, is in this truth telling, light giving, you know, moment where we actually say and believe the truth. We're scared of what it will cost us. And we're scared of losing, you know, out on the opportunity that we thought we were going to have, like our preconceptions of what this would look like. And really that paradigm shift or that invitation to having your mind blown and to be wrong is actually a death. There's a death involved. And I feel like as you were even describing that, I was like, it's not until you die to what you thought it was going to look like, or these traditional, you know, what people are saying it has to look like, that actually you can live to what it is that God has actually called you to, which is this kingdom that is not based on the powers of this world, right? It's this invisible kingdom. It's this like way that doesn't look like there's a way. So there's really something beautiful about that and costly about that. So I think that might be where people's fear are, even though we keep saying we serve a resurrection God, like where it looks like we're going to die. If it's, we're dying in faithfulness to God, there is resurrection. There is, God is on the move. He has things to do. He's got a lot of people to minister to and care for. So I love that resurrection story in so many ways. I love that it's okay because you have to die. You have to let go of what you thought, but actually you live to something as well.
Absolutely. And honestly, I think that is the great challenge for many ministers in this hour, because kind of like what I said before, that and I recently wrote an article somewhat addressing this related to a recent Rabbi Zacharias scandal. Mm-hmm. Of you have a lot of ministers who are playing the game, and there is a buddy system or a bro club when it comes to ministry, mm-hmm. where pastors and ministers and leaders, you know, kind of have each other's back, you know, regardless of what's going on and everything else. And I think one of the things that that God does require of those who are wanting to be faithful is not to hold power with a clutched fist, but with an open hand, like Christ did. We're supposed to understand power radically different than the way that the world understands power. Power is supposed to be given to us for the grant us the ability to serve and to empower others, not to build up our own platforms. And and at least for my life, I think that one of the things that the Lord, I think there was a test dynamic to that was, am I going to clutch power or am I going to let it go? And one of the things that was, I think, is interesting and just in reflection is that the way that the system is structured, people assume that everyone views power the same.
Right.
And I think this is especially true, even honest, just to be frank, when people think about minorities in ministry, where they think you're granted a little bit of power or the promise of power. And because you're going to think power the way that I think power, because it's been withheld from you, that you're going to jump at the opportunity to silence yourself or to say what we want you to say or not say and everything else because you want more power. And they don't anticipate the fact that there are a lot of people, this goes for minorities and women for that matter, mm-hmm. who are used to not having power. And so when you give them freedom or power, they don't have that same lust to be willing to compromise who they are for the sake of power.
Right.
You know, and so I think one of the challenges we're seeing today, one of the challenges and benefits we're seeing today is that people who've never had power are now using their power, their voice to speak up.
Yeah.
And without compromise. And then there are other people in ministry who have always had power. And what we're seeing is them trying to reassert that power in order to push other people out and in order to firmly establish their platforms. If that, I hope that makes sense. I'm not being too.
It makes perfect sense to me.
You know, I wrote a whole a chapter on power in a book I wrote called Better Together about women and men and trying to figure out how we're going to sort through this leading together thing when there's been so much abuse of power and, you know, as you know, as a counselor, even abuse just in general, just sheer terrible abuse. And I likened it a lot to like the old aristocracy, you know, of how it was just inherited power. And then all of a sudden the printing press is created, you know, like information is free. And now all of this like control of power is like, ah, it's over. And I see this picture of these old aristocratic sort of wealthy inherited power brokers moving out of these mansions because they've been bought out by new money and newly educated folks that now have power. And so there's this, so I was saying, you know, even to the boys club, just sort of like, you've got to figure out what you're going to do. Cause if you don't pivot, you're just going to be left with an empty, bankrupt, you know, thing that you're hanging on to for dear life, but you're losing it right now because there's been this massive power shift, even when it comes to voice. And this is the one of the things, like your letter to the evangelical church, your letter about Ravi Zacharias, like just out there, you know, thousands and thousands of people are reading this, hearing this, people telling their story through the Me Too movement, women, you know, 11 million of them sharing their own experiences. And like, who's stopping that? Like it's this. And then I think by the grace of God, we're seeing this exposure in the church of these frauds or fraudulent gospel or like leaders that are not who they say they are, you know, the duplicity of systems that have protected them for so long. So in so many ways, I think like this is evidence of this power shift. Of like, we're not gonna, who wants that old mansion anyway? It's hard to heat, you know, like who wants these, right? Like, it's just it's a time of like such upheaval. And I would say reformation for the church. And I see you as one of those reformers, like, let us tell the truth. Let us not be afraid. Let us confront fear in love. And I guess a couple questions I have for you. And I mean, I think you heard this. I did this kind of 5-point corrupt systems of power and how to identify if you're in a toxic culture. And really a lot of that was sparked by your letter to the evangelical church, which when I read, I wept because not just of what happened to your family, by just overt racism and, you know, just the sheer abuse of power. But also I wept because of how familiar the story was to me, both with people that I love and also in my own life. And that inclination for power systems to try to muzzle or to silence or to control and, you know, sort of get back in line that you just told us about your own paradigm movement. How do you protect yourself now, if I may ask, from cynicism?
That's a great question. And a question that really speaks into whether or not I actually am protecting myself from cynicism. So what I would say is that... let me think for a second and say, I used to think now part of this is how you define cynicism, because I think that there is kind of an urgency right now. And I think that when people see things as they really are, it will create a healthy kind of cynicism. And what I mean by that is that there are certain traditions, denominations, various other things that are, in my opinion, apostate. The Spirit of God has left, you know, and
it's. And one of these, Kyles, is the Southern Baptist Convention. You openly on Twitter said people should leave right now.
Yeah, I believe so. And one, and just to be specific there, I would say that I think people should leave because of the ways in which the Southern Baptist Convention still struggles with race issues several hundred years later. But I also think that should not be the reason, that should not be the straw that broke the camel's back. I think the sexual abuse scandal and the subsequent handling of the sexual abuse scandal by prominent and influential people within the Southern Baptist Convention should have been enough. So one of the things, even when I'm talking to other Black and brown people about whether or not they should stay or leave, one of the questions I ask, and just for the sake of moral consistency, is I'm glad that you're not going to tolerate the way you're considering leaving because of how you are treated within that space. But why isn't it enough about how your sisters have been treated in that space? Why wasn't that enough, you know, to switch? So I think that that's important. So what I would say is that I think that there's a lot of faithful Southern Baptists I'm thankful for Southern Baptist. I wouldn't have got my education without the cooperative program that knocked 50% off my tuition. So a family like mine that's not wealthy could be able to afford it. But despite the faithfulness in there, when it comes to the leadership, when it comes to those who actually have authority and power, there is a depth of corruption and indifference towards abuse and white nationalism and white supremacy that I don't personally understand why anyone would stay within that space beyond the financial resources that that space offers. And that should not be a legitimate reason to stay.
What do you think that there are people who are called to be a faithful witness in the midst of, like, what do you say about that?
That's a good question. And see, you're going to give me a little bit of trouble here, but what I would say,
we'll be in it together, Kyle. We'll be in it together.
So, that's a very common refrain when people are in toxic spaces to say that I feel like I've been called to stay in this space. Mm-hmm. And as a trauma-informed counselor, abuse counselor, I have trouble with that language and with that argument for staying in a space that is wounding people. Because if you truly grasp what that space is doing, you will not want to in any way be an enabler of that kind of pain that space is causing people. And so like for just to be, so to give you an example, what I would say to regarding the race issues, when Black people stay in a space that does not honor or respect them, they allow themselves to be tokenized in that space rather than be rebuked because of their absence. And so if the Southern Baptist Convention did not have any minorities, it would be a proper reflection of its heart. And so when minorities stay in that space, they give that organization the opportunity to say, no, we're good. Look, we have these people here.
Right. It legitimizes something that doesn't deserve legitimacy.
Exactly. And so I don't believe that God, so we talk about I've been called to stay in a space. I don't believe that God caused people to legitimize things that are hurting his children. The same Jesus that says, if any of you harm one of my little ones, mm-hmm. it will be worse for you than being, you know, than cast in the lake, you know,
tied around your neck. Yeah.
So if Jesus says that about those who harm his little ones, why would he cause someone to remain in a space that is indifferent to doing radical change to prevent the harm of its little ones, to legitimize it, to enable it. So I have trouble with that. I think what people are really saying in that or really communicating is that I don't want to, let's go as strong as say idolatry, but I think that they have committed themselves to a space without compromise. Mm-hmm. The only identity marker that I'm willing to anchor myself in is Christian. So I don't want to give too much, but yeah, I will just respond by saying, I don't think God calls people to stay. I don't think God calls healthy people and faithful people to stay in abusive or toxic spaces. I believe he calls faithful people to minister to those who have been wounded by said spaces, not legitimize them.
Well, and actually, I think what you're saying, and I, the reason I'm asking you this, Kyle, is because I've had a lot of good, healthy pushback on what my call out too was for people to leave if they're being abused or they're the toxic culture that they're in is so toxic that it's causing them a harm or causing harm to others. But I got a lot of pushback from people sort of saying, what if you feel called to stay and how will we change these cultures and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I thought, you know, this is a really fascinating subject because, how do you know when the toxicity? So I guess that I guess when you called it in the sense that this thing doesn't even want to change. Mm-hmm. And me staying in this system perpetuates that idea that there is no need to change. So then in that sense, I become complicit in this whole problem that will not be transformed because no one even sees a need or wants to do it. Whereas if you leave it, and you exit it, that even that might create a place where people want some kind of change. Like when they at least admit their need so in a sense, you're actually doing something good for the very organization that you're leaving, because you're hoping that one day they're going to say, because we believe in the redemption of all things, because we believe no one's too hard, it is never too late, and that Jesus can change people's hearts if they want to. So you're basically hoping that your absence will actually provoke them to the place where they're like, oh, wow, we got to do something about this.
Yeah, I mean, so just looking at some biblical principles here. First, you have Romans 11, where the Apostle Paul makes his appeal after laying out election, laying out, you know, God's call and everything else. He says, so what about the Jews? Are the Jews, you know, basically cut off? And he's like, no, God is rounding up the Gentiles. And as the very promised people of the very covenantally promised people of God, the Jews, look and behold that all these Gentiles are being brought into the kingdom. It is to provoke them to jealousy.
Right.
To realize that they're missing out on a promise that was originally theirs,
right,
which compels them to the cross.
Yeah.
Or you look at 1 Corinthians when it talks about those who the sexually immoral, and Paul says to put them outside the camp, hand them over to Satan. And what was supposed to happen there is that they are supposed to, when they're cut out, they realize that I had it good, that it was a grace to be in the community of God. And because of my evil and my sexual perversion, and everything else, I'm out of that. That is to provoke in them and a desire to come back to faithfulness.
Yeah.
And so what I would say is that the only way in my mind that a institution, denomination, a faith tradition can sometimes be called back or to come back to faithfulness. Now, we're talking about the Southern Baptist Convention. Come back to faithfulness is not really the language that I would use, but
come redeemed. To a point
of repent.
That's right. Repent of its centuries old lack of faithfulness. Some of the ways, the only thing in my mind that would lead to that is shame. The public shame of recognizing that we are a denomination that was formed out of white supremacy, and we're a denomination that has been fully handed over to white supremacy, not a denomination that has white supremacy tendencies that has minorities in it that were traumatizing. The minorities have now left us because of what we've done and who we are. That kind of shame, public shame, in my mind, is the only thing that will bring a denomination like that back. Let me say this real quick and say that in my mind, respectfully to those people who say I'm called to stay, what I would say is that for me, in my opinion, it takes a profound degree of hubris to think that you are going to be the one who is going to change a denomination that has had centuries to change and has not. Who has had countless people, prophets and ministers and teachers and preachers and pastors and scholars and theologians appealing, trying to help it come to faithfulness, who have all failed and left broken,
yeah,
that you think that you will be the one who is able to actually bring that denomination or that faith tradition to its rightful place.
Yeah,
I'm confident in the gifts that God has given me. I'm thankful for the gifts that God has given me, but I lack the self-assessment or degree of self-assessment to think for one second that I have that kind of power, that kind of giftedness, or that kind of sway to be able to move something that countless others have tried, failed, and left traumatized trying to do.
Like, not to put too fine a point on this, Martin Luther King Jr. was Southern Baptist. And if Martin Luther King Jr. couldn't do it, don't like...
Well, Martin Luther King Jr. had to go to a liberal seminary because my seminary, the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, wouldn't take him as a student because he was Black. So, I mean... I just think that... I think that humility is making you having a healthy assessment of self. False humility is thinking too highly of yourself or thinking too lowly of yourself. Humility is having an accurate assessment of self. I would find it personally difficult for me to have an accurate assessment of self to conclude that you have the ability and power to transform a denomination where countless others of all walks of life's gifts and skills have not only failed, but have been left broken and traumatized. for you to think that. So maybe I just lack lack an imagination. I don't know. But that's where I'm at, as the saying goes.
Yeah, I thought it was a powerful, and I actually think as a prophetic action. You know, I remember Alan Hirsch years ago telling me, like, why don't women just walk out of the church one Sunday and show everybody how the church couldn't go on without women? Like, even in some of the most patriarchal concepts, abusive places, women run the show, you know, still behind the scenes, right? So he's like, why don't you just all walk out one Sunday and then just have a conversation based on, like, okay, how are you going to do this church thing without us kind of thing? I never got around to organizing it, but I think it's up my sleeve. Wait for it.
So you want to know why? One of the reasons why I don't think that would work, alongside why I don't think it would work for minorities to do that, is because there will always be enough of that marginalized community.
Yeah.
That desires power over being humanized and right. over dignity.
And or so like a sense of belonging or allegiance yes. or loyalty.
So there will always be the women who are like, no, we
like it this way. Yeah.
Yeah. Because they will be offered a degree of power, or there'll always be certain minorities who will be offered a degree of power if they become voices against the majority of that minority. And so they become the token minorities who tear down the majority and they're elevated.
Right.
And so the human nature component's the problem, where having that kind of collective consciousness right. without some being willing to compromise for power, the siren call of power is just too beautiful for some.
Right. Okay. Now I've got two questions for you. One, where are you calling people to go? So I hear the call to exit, and fair enough. And I, you know, even when I was researching the Billy Graham rule, just for trying to get to grips with, like, how men and women can work together when they're segregated and not allowed to see each other. And as I was researching the Southern Baptist, where that came from, I actually came across that this whole history of the Southern Baptist Convention being formed to defend and support slavery. And then wondered to myself, how can this be? Like, how can this even be? And what are they going to do now? So I guess one question I have is, like, where are you hoping people will go? Where do they find their belonging? Where do they find their community? And then two, well, answer that one first and I'll tell you number two.
Yes, if I'm going to have to rephrase that or reframe that a little bit in order to answer. What I would say is, so my main push as a soul care provider who deals a lot with spiritual abuse and spiritual trauma would be, one, I never recommend anyone to stay in an abusive environment. Mm-hmm. And so one thing I don't want to do is seem like I'm just picking on, like, say, the SBC.
Yeah, there's a lot of them. There's a lot of them.
Yeah, so I want to kind of pull back a little bit to a bird's eye view and say, what I would say is, I would not suggest anyone ever stay in an abusive environment. Mm-hmm. And if there is an environment that you are in that is abusive, in regards to the promises, the promises broken, the ways in which they move, the ways in which they relate to you, the dignity dynamics and everything else, then I don't think that you should stay in that space for the sake of your own soul, mm-hmm. and mental health care for that matter. And so to whatever degree that the Southern Baptist Convention is abusive in its hand of dealings with women, children, and minorities, I would say you should not be in that space. Same thing goes for Presbyterian, the PCA, all the various Presbyterian denominations, and all the other kind of non-denominational denominations.
Yeah,
you know, and all those things.
All the places where toxicity lives. Yep.
Yeah, and then I would say this is that. As I am a Baptist, I am a Congregationalist. I believe that a congregation should be the, I think that it's enough to identify as Christian. And I think that it's enough to identify with a faith family or a faith mm-hmm. community. Mm-hmm. And so who you are connected with locally matters much, much more than who you are connected nationally. I personally think that we are, and I was just talking with an Asian brother about this, about should we create new denominations for minorities, for, you know, just, you know, all those kinds of things. So there's other options. And one of the things I told him was, I think that a new denomination may be the way to go, but I wonder whether or not we're actually heading towards a direction of the death of the denomination itself. Yeah. Where denominations are going to be a thing of the past, because there was a time where so you have first tier issues like the doctrine of the Trinity.
Yeah.
And then you had presupposed issues like the affirmation of humanity of all peoples.
Yeah.
There was a time where I never thought a question that I would have to have answered before I could fellowship with someone was, do you believe Black Lives Matter? That was never on my radar.
Right.
But I'm more than happy to fellowship with someone who is Paedo Baptist, despite me being Credo as a Baptist. So someone who baptizes infants versus someone who baptizes just believers. I'm way more inclined to fellowship and do mission work with a Presbyterian than I am with someone the Baptist who can't affirm the dignity of my life or those that look like me.
Right.
And so I think that there's a radical reshaping of theological convictions in regards to the importances of various kinds of things. And that's where denominations come in. Denominations are essentially national collectives that all identify to certain theological and doctrinal principles.
Yeah.
So like, again, Baptist Faith and Message, for example, for the Southern Baptist Convention. If you believe the Baptist Faith and Message, then you can be a Southern Baptist church. What that means, though, is that if you're a female pastor, then you're considered unfaithful and outside the camp. But if you're a white Christian nationalist who ran an insurrection on the capital of the America that led to death and violence, then you can still be a faithful standing member of a Southern Baptist church and in faithful unity communion.
Right.
So it means that you can be... You can be a white supremacist who's divisive on social media, stirring up hate and bigotry towards your Black brothers and sisters on your social media feed, and be a pastor and even on the executive team of the Southern Baptist Convention. But if you don't expel people who have same-sex attraction in your church but are operating out of orthodox sexual ethics, then you can be excommunicated.
Right.
Does that make sense? And so denominations are
fickle
in regards to these the theological and doctrinal commitments. And I wonder whether or not we're entering into a space in theological history or Christian history where the denominational dynamic is going to go away. Quick example. When you think about churches in persecuted countries, you don't see denominations as clearly distinguishable as you see over here, because over there it's Christ crucified. Mm-hmm. You know, and that you don't have the time or the wherewithal to be dissecting all the theological finer points when it's like they want your head and anyone else who loves Jesus is a brother or sister.
And yeah. So, and they have no power, like worldly power, to hold on to. So what are they, you know, when we think about the construct of like, what is a denomination? Like, anyway, I agree with you on this. I think the new reformation of the church is literally the undoing of a denominational sectarianism.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So I'm way more chill with fellowshipping with a sister who is a survivor than I am. And we can have all kinds of theological differences. And I'm very convictional theologically, but I'm way more inclined to get coffee with her than with a Reformed Baptist who loves the patristics and the reformers who says all lives matter or blue lives matter. Or pro-Trump. I'm hanging out with that sister. We have the fact that we both survived abuse in common and we love Jesus. We can talk about all these other kinds of things.
Yeah, we can figure it out together in community. So it's basically like people who are open to relationship and connection and with Jesus as a sovereign leader in that regard towards reconciliation, then everyone's welcome there. But if you're not open to relationship and right relationship and reconciliation, you're not open to a journey, then what is there to even talk about, kind of thing. If you could, Kyle, let's just say the Southern Baptist Convention leadership team was here on this podcast, and they were like, Kyle, here's five minutes. We're giving you 5 minutes to make your, what would you say to them? What do you want them to do? Like, what would, if it was a perfect world and like, they were just like, we're cut to the heart. We've heard Kyle on Twitter and we want to know, what must we do to be saved? What would you say?
Well, so I would start probably with telling them that when it comes to the unbelieving ward, love is a noun. It's a thing. It's an action. It's a thing. It's something that you either, something that you simply merely just give or you have for someone. In the biblical sense of love, love is a verb. It's active. It's constant. It pursues. And there is no going forward for the Southern Baptist Convention or any theological expression that is not, that does not truly walk in love. And that may sound kind of cliche-ic, but what I mean by that, when as it fleshes out, is as of right now, to this day, I have not seen any evidence that the Southern Baptist Convention leadership loves women and loves children or loves minorities. Because if they loved women and children, then we would have seen many, many more people, not only on their faces, tearing their clothes in sackcloth and ashes and pouring ashes on their head, weeping in regards to these things, but we would see radical actions seeking to transform the denomination and to protect women and children. People, the baseline of what is acceptable hasn't even been met. They still refuse to even establish a registry so wow. that abusive and predatory pastors aren't rehired at other churches.
Wow.
So the baseline of what is necessary hasn't been met when there's a refusal to even establish a registry based on the excuse of church autonomy. So, because again, churches aren't autonomous when it comes to electing female pastors.
Right.
You elect female pastors, every Southern Baptist church and its mama is going to get together and be like, you're out. But when it comes to sexual abuse, it's like
church autonomy. You. Right.
Yeah. And so until there's love that leads to action, and when action being not only sincere lament, sincere brokenness, but then sincere practices to change, there cannot be any change unless there's actually genuine love towards minorities, especially Black. Then you'll never see diversity in leadership. You'll never see a willingness to share power rather than do everything you can to maintain it and keep others out.
Yeah.
You know, and so what, at the end of the day, there is a profound love problem within the Southern Baptist Convention. And people can parse it different ways in regards to sociologically, theologically, biblically, and all these things. But at the end of the day, that problem has existed. It's what it was birthed out of.
Yeah.
One of the things that's super important to understand is that the sexual abuse scandal that happened a few years ago that still hasn't been handled wasn't out of pocket. It was the fruit of its slavery problem. Mm-hmm. Because it's the same sin of greed and pride that justified slavery, that justifies and dismisses the using of bodies, of women bodies. All,
yes.
Abuse. Slavery was abuse. Chattel slavery was abuse. It was actually a form of sexual abuse.
Yes.
And so there is a connection between the two, which demonstrates a lack of repentance as it relates to what it looks like to love the other. And so what the appeal that the foundational appeal that I would make would be one related to love, and say that you guys have, the Southern Baptist Convention has yet to, regardless of all the resolutions that you guys have made, all the empty promises, it serves as nothing but mere gaslighting if you have not truly repented and sought to change in regards to your love for others, which there's no fruit of that. The next thing that I would say is that there has to be a better understanding of power dynamics. Mm-hmm. That's not going to happen as long as the Southern Baptist Convention is more preoccupied with critical race theory than it is with white nationalism, because the foundations of Southern Baptist Convention is white supremacy. And if it's more preoccupied with a social science theory that addresses dynamics of systemic power than it is with the people who are trying to perpetuate white power within the denomination, then they're never going to actually see any kind of change. And so then there has to be a revisiting and assessment of how does the Southern Baptist Convention understand power, and does it recognize that the abuse of power is actually heresy, because the abuse of power is a demonstration of an is Antichrist.
Yeah, absolutely.
Jesus, who was in the form of God, didn't count equality with God as a thing to be grasped, but was willing to lower himself even to the point of being lower than the angels. And so there's a Christology to the abuse of power, which says that Jesus is a manipulator, that Jesus is not the humble servant, but rather Jesus is one who wields his power and weaponizes it against his people. And so as long as the Southern Baptist Convention isn't using its power, and that includes its resources, to actually serve the marginalized, actually advocate for the marginalized, but rather is using it to prop up people who are espousing the opposite, then there's a serious blind spot as it relates to how it understands power. And that lack of understanding of the lack of understanding can never help it move past its ancient heresy of power is to be used to oppress others and to marginalize the voices of others. Does that make sense?
Power makes sense. Mic drop. I mean, I hope they hear this. I hope somebody hears this somewhere, because
someone's going to hear it. They're going to hear it.
But I mean, thanks for saying it. And I think just so also well articulated. I was talking to a pastor on a podcast the other day, and his church is complementarian. So he was saying, like, can you talk to us about how we can still get along while we sort of struggle through this? And I was like, yeah, sure. And so the example he gave me was a woman who wrote to say, like, she feels called to lead and to preach, but is willing to lay that down to appease the male folks who are threatened by that. And I said, that's great. Like, kudos to the woman, but that's the opposite of Christ's example of power. Jesus laid down the person with the most power. If you want to be Christ-like, anybody in the room, whatever the room is, whoever has the most power lays the power down for the least. That's the Christ-like, that's the Philippians 2 example of why Jesus is so profoundly powerful in a different way, is he lays his power down. So, but what happens in power dynamics, well, as you just laid out here so clearly and better than me, but the idea that those with the most power make people with less power sacrifice their power for them to keep their power. I'm like, dude, that's Rome, man. That's like, that's literally what Jesus said not to do.
I can speak to that real quickly. This may be a little bit off topic for at least for, you know, what you guys want to talk to me about, but I feel so, I desire so much as a brother to just speak to that real quickly.
Yeah.
And say that. So even in a complementarian church, I think one of the problems you have is when one thinks of a pastor, they think about a position of power. That itself is problematic to me as a congregationalist, because the keys of the kingdom were not handed to anyone, any single man. It was handed to the church. The congregation should be the one with power.
Right.
So the fact that even in these conversations, that power is what's central, demonstrates that it's the lust, that it's what everyone's after. It's power. It's not service, because it's whoever is in a position of leadership. It kind of what you said is that it's all looked at from the level of power. What I would say is that if power is being used rightly in that space, even if it was a complementarian space, a pastor who understands the power that has been given to them would say, you want to preach? You want leadership? Well, let's look at different ways in the church where you can be preaching and teaching and leading Bible studies. And let's look at ways in which you, in fact, you know, I need to be learning from women, and I need to be having women in my ear to tell me the various ways of and the challenges and issues that you guys have. Why don't we develop a leadership team of women who can come alongside, you know, the pastors and help them understand the various challenges and difficulties that women have. So let's grant you leadership. Let's get you in a place where you're able to exercise those gifts of teaching. Let's do it everything that I can to give power to you so that you are able to serve the church, rather than
you wouldn't just tell her to go home. Sorry, I'm just picking on your denomination again. It was so easy. It was low hanging fruit.
It is low hanging fruit. And what I would say is that to me is I'm trying to think of the best way to say this, but I don't know how one reconciles that with the fear of God. Like, do you not fear the Lord to think that if God has given sisters gifts, and he gives all his people different gifts, as he gives the gifts of teaching to men and women, if he gives one of his daughters the gift to teach, and you have the audacity to try to silence or muzzle that sister from exercising her God-given gifts, I would personally be, I have too much fear of the Lord to operate out of that kind of audacity.
Right.
I'm going to, even if theologically I hold to a view that the office of pastor should be held by a man, in that office, I'm going to be doing everything that I can to fulfill that woman's, that my sister, mind you, her call in which, when how she wants to serve the Lord and what, and exercise her gifts. Because on that last day, I want all father saying, well done, good and faithful brother, for the way in which you partnered in ministry with your sister. I don't want to hear from the Lord, why did you put a muzzle over my daughter's mouth? You know, and so to me, I got questions in regards to whether or not people truly fear God when
again, you're talking out of a framework of relationship, which is the point, not the product, right? So that's, again, it changes everything. This is a mind-blowing paradigm, people, when you actually look through your theology and your practice and your structures and your systems through the lens of relationship.
Rather than power.
Right. And even functionality and all that stuff, like relationship is the center of all. This is the gospel. This is right. Relationships is literally the good news of the gospel. Kyle, we are so thrilled. Both of us just sitting here spellbound and mind blown. And again, we affirm what you're saying. We love it. We love how you're challenging us, even in the way that we're thinking. Keep it up. Keep being that wide, wide world prophetic witness. How can people support what you're doing now? Where do they connect with you? How can they give to what it is that God is calling you to do?
Yeah, thank you. So you can follow me on Twitter at Kyle James Howard. My website is kylejhoward.com, and there is a support tab on my website, and which has options of one-time gifts of support, or you can become a Patreon. A patron is basically offering monthly support to fund my ministry at this point. I'm actually in the process of establishing a nonprofit organization to expand on what I'm currently doing right now.
Great.
But what I primarily do right now is I offer free trauma-informed soul care to victims of spiritual abuse and trauma or rape in the church or racial trauma in the church. And so when minorities who have experienced racial trauma in the church or have experienced spiritual abuse in the church reach out seeking soul care, they lack the economic means to be able to pay for counseling. My patron support allows me to offer them free counseling without my family starving, and with and allowing
that's us beautiful. To have a roof over our head. That's so beautiful.
Yeah, and so if you would like to partner with me through providing support, so that I'm able to do the work of providing soul care for Christians who lack the resources to be able to pay for it themselves, then if you go to my website under my support tab, you can either give a one-time donation, or again, you can become a monthly patron. And hopefully within the next month or two, COVID has kind of set things back. I was supposed to launch middle of last year, but hopefully in like a month or two, I'll be launching my nonprofit. It's called Lighting a Path. Mm-hmm. And the nonprofit is going to seek to do that on a broader scale. Again, providing trauma-informed soul care and partnering with counselors and therapists around the country that are racially and culturally aware to provide trauma-informed care to people in a way where it's not triggering or even adding to the trauma.
Re-traumatizing,
re-traumatizing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's wonderful.
When that launches, it'll be giving will be tax deductible and all those things. But as of right now, the best way is website support, and then giving one-time support or becoming a monthly patron, which allows me to, again, provide care free of charge and still provide for my family.
That's wonderful. Well, hey, listen, we're praying for you. We're supporters of you. So everyone listening to this, go check out Kyle and support him. And let's bless the work of the Lord in this season and what God's calling you to, not just from, but also to. He's always calling us to the work of the kingdom. So thanks for all that you're doing, and God bless you.
Same to you. Thank you guys for having me.